Welcome back to Research Unpacked from the Informed Performance Podcast. My name is Dylan Carmody, and I'm a physical therapist and strength and conditioning coach from the U.S. On today's episode, I sit down with Colin Griffin to unpack his recent PhD on Achilles tendon injury rehabilitation and lower limb biomechanics. This was a great conversation where we dive into Colin's unique background that has influenced his rehabilitation approach, his PhD work that considers Achilles tendinopathy and various profiling methods associated with this pathology, and finally, we dive into methods of determining readiness for return to sport. We hope you enjoy the show.
This episode of the Informed Performance Podcast has been sponsored by Vol Performance, makers of the Force Frame. Used by health and performance professionals for assessing and improving performance and rehabilitation, the Force Frame is a powerful solution for quickly and accurately testing isometric strength and imbalances. In addition to testing athletes, the Force Frame is also used to maintain and improve strength, offering over 130 isometric training protocols. As a portable and easy-to-use system, the Force Frame is designed to ensure every measurement can be accurately and reliably measured, time after time again. To learn more about the Force Frame, visit our sponsor, volperformance.com.
Colin Griffin, welcome to the Informed Performance Podcast.
Thank you, Dylan. Pleasure to be on.
Right on. Well, so to kick things off, I think we should probably just start off with a brief intro to you if the listeners, you know, haven't heard your name quite yet or aren't familiar with much of the work that you've done. So I'll hand the floor over to you and just give yourself a bit of an introduction.
Yeah, so I'm based in Dublin. I work in the UPMC Sports Surgery Clinic. I'm a strength and conditioning coach by trade, but my main role in the clinic is a lower limb rehabilitation specialist. So I deal a lot with, like, as the title goes, lower limb injuries, foot, ankle, calf, Achilles, but pretty much anything below the hip, but with a particular interest in foot and ankle and calf area, and Achilles tendon, as I mentioned. So I've been working there actually 10 years this month. I don't know where the time has gone, but I guess really lucky to work in our clinic is part of a bigger, now it's part of a big hospital group because UPMC are an international company originally based in the States, but they've acquired a couple of private hospitals in Ireland and a few other countries as well. But our particular clinic that was originally the Sports Surgery Clinic was established in 2007. It's a large private orthopedic hospital. Our sports medicine department has grown a lot over the last 10 years. And, our department, we have 4 staff, which includes sports and exercise medicine consultants, physiotherapists, S&C coaches, biomechanics lab staff, research assistants. And I guess as part of the wider hospital, like, you know, we're constantly interacting with our radiology department, our surgeons. So, one thing I've learned a lot is just, I've learned from other practitioners, from other disciplines, and I suppose cross-pollinated our skill sets. And in my line of work, I suppose when I'm dealing with different injuries, having a basic understanding of radiology, a basic understanding of medicine, and a basic understanding of, you know, surgical techniques and that, it makes my decision-making a lot easier when I want to try and point a tricky patient in the right direction, and I suppose have good conversations with those, you know, whether it's a surgeon, whether it's a sports medicine doctor, or radiologist for discussing MRI findings. So it's been a very steep learning curve, and then I suppose I was fortunate then to be able to do a PhD, which I started in 2017 and finished around this time last year as well. Looking at Achilles tendon injuries and lower limb biomechanics. So that was a big undertaking, as it is for anyone who takes on a PhD, but I'm fortunate I was able to build it into my work. Which is good in terms of having support for collecting data and having easy access to patients and participants. But obviously time is always a factor as well. So trying to fit in time for the crucial parts of writing up and trying to get work published in that as well. So look, I'm an athlete as well. So I had a long career in elite sport. I was a 50k race walker, competed 2 Olympic Games, and retired from competitive sports just over 10 years ago. And I still run semi-competitively at the moment and aim to do 1 or 2 marathons a year just to keep something in the pipeline to aim towards. So yeah, that's my background in a nutshell.
Colin, that's awesome. I gotta say, I mean, you're certainly not the first PhD to be on the podcast, but I think you might be the first Olympian. So that's pretty exciting. So something you had mentioned was, you know, obviously your background within strength and conditioning, and then now working a little bit more on the, obviously it's a continuum, but working a little bit more on the rehabilitation side of things. How have you found that dynamic working with other, you know, more classically trained physios, and like where do you feel like your background kind of helps you out, or where do you feel like you've tried to, I guess, learn from other physios in the space?
Yeah, no, good question, because you know, when I started working in the clinic, you know, coming in as a strength and conditioning coach background, and as well as having an athlete background as well, my natural sort of home would be that sort of mid to end stage phase of rehab and getting people back to performance. But working alongside physios, you know, I started learning a lot more about the early stage management of injuries and even some of the diagnostics. And I guess on the flip side, you know, along with my strength and conditioning colleagues, we were able to help, I suppose, give physios more experience at the mid to end stage rehab. So we kind of, I suppose, as I said, cross-pollinated skill sets. I become a lot more experienced and confident with the early management of things and some of my diagnostics. And then, I suppose, physios then start to be more confident pushing that towards the end of the rehab pathway and back to sport and to be helped with those kind of, with that transition. So yeah, look, I suppose we just interact among each other. You know, we almost operate as one, you know, in a work environment, and we put a big emphasis on CPD and have weekly CPD sessions on a particular topic where physios, S&C coaches and our biomechanics staff, you know, we get our heads together and discuss different cases and that as well. So yeah, look, I mean, it's been, I suppose the experience of working in the clinic and also our emphasis on CPD has probably helped drive that.
That's it's a super cool environment. It's it seems kind of where a lot of areas are hopefully trying to push to in terms of the interdisciplinary framework and being able to work alongside a multitude of different practitioners. But that sounds awesome.
Yeah, it's so important because helps you see the bigger picture things and have a more holistic approach to things. And because if you're stuck in one sort of discipline and don't see out beyond that lens, you know, you miss things and you're limiting yourself. So it's really important just to see the bigger, the panoramic view of things.
Yeah, definitely. So speaking of kind of all of that, I think we should sort of dive right in the fact that, you know, you're kind of somebody who I feel like is positioned in a very unique area, and that you have, you know, experiences as an elite athlete, right? You have been, you know, developing a lot of like these kind of applied and clinical reps, for over years and years, right? You said about 10 years now. And then also you've recently completed your PhD. And so you kind of have like this Venn diagram intersection of a whole bunch of different, you know, experiences, and expertise areas. And so, when you get somebody walking in your door with an Achilles tendon issue, based on all those different experiences, where does your assessment process, or what does your assessment process really look like? Where does your head go?
Yeah. So I guess, what type of patient am I dealing with? Are they elite athlete? Are they recreational? Are they recreational sports person? Are they like general population, also age profile? You know, are they young, late teens, early 20s, or are they middle to older age, or are they older age? And then I suppose, you know, if they're in that sort of young athletic population age category, you know, I suppose what training factors may have contributed to the injuries. So again, a good subjective history is important. If they're a little bit older, whether they're sporty or not, you know, I suppose you're always keeping your eye out for other things that might impact it, other health conditions that might contribute to the development or the persistence of a tendinopathy. You know, have they got, you know, what's their metabolic health look like? Have they any other systemic conditions, inflammatory disease, autoimmune conditions, you know, early cardiovascular disease, or any family history of it? So you're just taking, I suppose, a wide screen for those things if they haven't been picked up before. And then if it's a young person, then a younger person or a athletic person, you know, we try to assess a broad mix of athletic qualities and see what impairments they may have that may have contributed to the injury or may be there as a consequence of the injury, whether that's impaired calf strength, whether it's impaired plyometric ability or explosive strength, if there's any altered gait patterns in the running or any other movements might do relevant to the sport. And I suppose not being clear on the diagnosis too, like, you know, if they come in and haven't had a proper diagnostic assessment done, they might admit portion of Achilles pain, but I suppose we want to make sure it is tendinopathy and not missing out. And if there's a potential, it could be like a peritonitis, or if there's plantaris involvement or something else in that area. So just you know, working through the differential diagnosis as well. So yeah, look, building a profile of the person you're dealing with, their sporting or physical activity background, their health background, what their goals are, any factors that might have given clues how the condition developed. And then long curve is how they're presenting with and how we might maybe bust it all hanging fruit to try and tackle first.
I like that. I think a lot of times we can get sucked into immediately looking into specific assessments or outcome measures or, you know, areas in terms of, you know, well, we want to get a rate of force development measure, or we want to get something like this immediately or something along those lines. Whereas, again, I think taking a global view and a larger perspective, kind of like we were alluding to before, I was just making sure like, okay, cool. Is this person in the right place at the right time, first and foremost? And then from there, we can build a plan to move forward. But I guess for context, let's move past that. And let's look at maybe you have a elite sport athlete, given the population of our listeners. I think they'd probably side more with wanting to learn more about that. Yeah. They can be, you know, maybe a runner, just given your experience with that kind of population. And maybe they've been dealing with mid-portion Achilles pain for the last couple months, right? We'll call it 3 or 4 months. And then they come to see you. Where does your process kind of lead you into from a assessment standpoint? What qualities are you looking at? How are you testing those qualities? And then maybe training history and those sorts of things. What are some things that could lead you down different rabbit holes?
Sure. Yeah. So So at the start, I've been trying to build a picture. So my basic clinical assessments are: I see what they're like hopping. Number one, are they sore hopping on one leg? And what's their strategy to hop? Are they very plantar flex and land on the ball of the foot to keep the heel off the ground, or do they let the heel touch the ground, or are they kind of more of a midfoot strike when they hop? And then I will see what. I have a look at their calf shape, so I get them to face away from me, do some slow double leg heel raises, and just get a rough eyeball of what their calf shape and everything looks like. Look at the shape of the medial gastroc, the lateral gastroc, which can easily be visualized, and see if there are any big asymmetries sticking out between the injured limb and the uninjured limb. And oftentimes, there's been a couple of papers, papers published that show that the lateral gastroc tends to suffer the most in Achilles tendinopathy in terms of having reduced neural drive to that particular muscle, which is the smallest of the three calf muscles, but at the same time, you want to make sure it's doing its fair share of contribution. So I look for that, whether it's lateral gastric or medial gastric, if there's some signs of atrophy compared to the uninjured side. Again, looking for that, and then I'll see how they go about doing a calf raise. Do they tend to turn the foot out and load through the lateral border of the foot, or do they tend to keep a neutral foot and load more through the first MTP joint? See what the strategy is, and then I'll do a calf endurance test using a metronome of 1 second up, 1 second down, or a metronome of 60 beats per minute, and see how many good calf raises they can do in at that sort of tempo, and see how many reps they can do before they start to fatigue or show signs of deterioration in their ability to do it, and that gives a measure of calf capacity. And then I suppose still while we're in the clinical setting, I'll look a little bit around the body and look at do some test of some of the synergistic muscles. So look at their ankle inversion and eversion strength using a handheld dyno. Maybe look at big toe flexor strength using handheld dyno. And then look further up and to do some manual muscle testing on their hip abduction and hip extension and maybe hamstring strength as well. And yeah, for the more athletic people, we will then arrange a isokinetic strength test. So get a proper measure of peak torque. So our protocol, the joint angular velocity is 30 degrees a second, so it's quite a slow speed. So you're getting a probably good measure of maximal strength or close to it. And yeah, we measure plantar flexure peak torque and dorsiflexion peak torque. And then with our setup, we can also measure their torque at 20 degrees plantar flexion, so inner range plantar flexion, and then outer range plantar flexion. So look at a 10 degrees dorsiflexion angle. So you get joint angle specific torque and plantar flexion, dorsiflexion, and also peak torque, and also dorsiflexion torque. So we got, on one hand, we got a measure of calf capacity in terms of how many reps they can do and at that sort of metronome rhythm, and then also then have a sort of maximal strength or sub max strength, like from the isokinetic test. And in some cases, we might do a CV calf or isometric strength test as well to get a measure of peak force in the soleus. And then we will do usually a drop jump, vertical drop jump, double leg and single leg, and sometimes maybe a single leg horizontal rebound as well, and then look at the running gait. So again, building the picture of what good athletic quality they have and what maybe relevant athletic qualities are missing or impaired, and that will determine where to start the rehab journey.
I love that. I think there's a lot of great takeaways there. Diving a little bit more into the isokinetics that you were touching on, I think a lot of times you can look into some papers that show, you know, there's different
position force like deformities that will happen with like the knee joint, right? So if you have a patellar or a quadriceps tendon issue, sometimes you'll have that like kind of camel hump type deformity within an isokinetic test. Do you see similar kind of curve shapes or those sorts of kind of profiles when you're dealing with individuals with various kind of calf or Achilles impairments, or is it generally just total force kind of drops as a whole?
So like, obviously their peak torque is going to occur in slight dorsiflexion. So we work between 20 degrees dorsiflexion and 30 degrees plantar flexion. So you'll see the curve, again, I'm trying to describe it as best I can verbally, but you'll see the peak torque occurring somewhere usually 5 to 10 degrees dorsiflexion. And you see it slowly drop off as they work into plantar flexion. It's like a taper drop off for the plantar flexion part of it. Whereas dorsiflexion is a little bit more of a little bit more horizontal throughout range. And then so it's getting less and less as you continue to raise dorsiflexion. But yeah, the plantar flexor torque, it's kind of like a, it just tapers off from dorsiflexion into plantar flexion. And I suppose that the torque at 20 degrees plantar flexion is relevant for those who've had an Achilles tendon rupture. That's where the biggest impairments tend to persist for a little longer, but I know we're going off topic a little bit there on that, but sometimes that type of information is useful.
Yeah, definitely. And to be honest, it's more or less like any kind of deficits are useful. I think the perspective that I was coming from was trying to figure out if there were certain profiles, so whether it was an Achilles tendon rupture, whether it's a mid-portion Achilles tendinopathy, whether it's insertional, or maybe if it's just like recurrent calf strains, like if there are different shapes on the force position curve with the isokinetics that they sort of create based on the profile of the athlete.
If you're comparing between injured and uninjured or injured athletes versus uninjured athletes, you'll probably see they may not get as high of a peak when they're in dorsiflexion compared to the uninjured leg or the uninjured athlete. So they have a slightly lower starting point if they've got big impairments. But overall, the shape of the curve is, it kind of goes high to low at an angle, if that makes sense. I'm not sure if I've explained it very well.
No, it sounds great. You had kind of alluded to this a little bit beforehand with talking about whether they're like an elite athlete or not, but are there any other criteria that you use? Because I think, a lot of times, we can say like, okay, yeah, isokinetics are gold standard for assessing force production, all those sorts of factors. But sometimes it's not always that feasible. You guys kind of have like a little bit of a funnel to sort of check off or criteria to say, okay, we've already assessed the low hanging fruit of this individual. Now it's time to get this isokinetic assessment because they're still having issues. Or do you have certain criteria for who gets this kind of isokinetic assessment or not?
Most of the patients do, even the, maybe even our, if they play any sport at all, we do try and encourage them to do an isokinetic test. Obviously it's accessible for us in the clinic. So it's easy for us to do it. Obviously not as feasible or as accessible in other environments. And what we have is like, profile related sort of targets. So we measure peak torque relative to body weight. And for our elite athletes, we aim for like peak torque of upwards of 106% body weight. For say recreational sports person, maybe about 130% body weight. Again, we often find that the bigger mass, say like in Ireland, if we test a lot of the rugby players, some of our national and provincial players, so guys are maybe 100 kilos more or more. It doesn't quite equate the same. They might, good for them, might still be about 130 kilos, So I think there's maybe potential there to use allometric scaling to see this, can you correct for muscle mass, or muscle dimensions, and maybe be a little bit more generous with the peak torque or peak force targets relative to body weight. Whereas it's probably easier for a lighter person to reduce almost twice body weight at peak torque compared to a 100 kilo person. So yeah, we take the sport into account. We take their age profile and we've been forced to be building these protocols over the last 10 years. We've got a very, very large database and we can subgroup them into different, as an age profile, sporting profiles, and even in the future, maybe look at body dimensions, body mass profiles, and have some normative values based on that. I suppose isokinetic testing is our main go-to. And not every time, sometimes I will do a seated calf isometric as well, just to, as a sport of test and to look a bit more at the soreness specifically. Whereas obviously with our isokinetic protocol, we do a straight legs, we're getting a measure of total plantar flexor, peak torque. yeah, the Isaac Knight test is our main sort of objective strength test that we do.
When it comes to this, like bent knee, straight knee kind of assessments and all those sorts of areas, I think there tends to be, you know, very strict setups in how we accomplish these sorts of testing, because again, we want them to be repeatable. We want them to be valid, all those sorts of factors. We've had a previous guest on the show. You might be familiar with it, James Moore. He's done like a testing setup before where he is in standing, but the knee is still bent. I don't want to paraphrase too much, but I think the rationale behind that is the Achilles and the calf is something that's pretty hard to hide from if there's force going through it. And so it's still technically getting, or the perspective that he was bringing was like, it's still technically giving some sort of measure of what the calf has the capacity to tolerate. And so I was just curious to see if you have, beyond, you know, the traditional assessments of maybe bent knee, straight knee, those sorts of things, have you played around with any alternative testing setups, or anything along those lines?
Yeah, no, I'm familiar with the test that that James uses. We have like played about a little bit doing a standing calf isometric. I think it requires a lot of precision to get right, because you know, it's hard not to, you don't know how much, you know, you're getting a measure of a vertical peak force, if you're in the force bit, and without some some kinematic assessments like 3D motion capture and working with the joint moments, you don't know how much contribution is coming from the calf. It is large, you know, but it can vary from person to person. You don't know if it's, you know, 60% or 80%, and how much the hip extensors and quads are contributing as well. What threw me off that a little bit was I had one athlete who was coming after my Achilles tendon rupture, and he had a 30% deficit on isokinetic test, and then an acetyl calf isometric test, he also had a 30% deficit. And then when we did a standing isometric test, and again, it's purely just a test of water and see, he has symmetry. And I'm like, that doesn't make sense. So how is he compensating for, now you can see like he still had a quite a pronounced atrophied calf. You know, he was only less than 20 weeks after his rupture. So that just got me thinking that there's ways and means of maybe cheating a standing isometric test, particularly when it's still a compound movement. And as much as you're trying to plantar flex and let that be the prompt, the main primary mechanism, you just don't know how much the hip extensors and the knee extensors are contributing. So yeah, I tried it, but I've just kind of not, in our environment, obviously when you have the benefit of having the Isaac Knight test, you know, we just go with that for a straight leg test. But I think if you're really strict with the setup, and if you're able to use some sort of even 2D motion capture where you can, you know, make sure that the ankle, knee and hip is vertically aligned, and, you know, if you get them nice and tall, and maybe using a block under the ball of the foot, so they're getting proper leverage through the foot, and then, you know, you're getting a bit more from the plantar flexure. So I think if you're really precise with it, you can be reasonably accurate with it. And, you know, I'm sure James' setup is fairly rock solid from that point of view. But I suppose having time to do that as well, you know. Look, I said we just haven't, because we have the advantage of using the Isaac Knight test for straight leg stuff.
Yeah, I fully agree. I think especially when you have an isokinetic machine in your back pocket, it's hard not to opt for that pretty often.
Yeah.
So one thing that I kind of selfishly wanted to talk to you about, because I've heard you talk about it a couple times and those sorts of things, was this idea of the gastrocnemius runout. And, you know, from an anatomical consideration, understanding what that structure is, you know, what we know about it, what role it could play when it comes to injury or performance. I would just love to kind of hear a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So the gastric runout, or what's also called a free gastric aponeurosis, is when you are at the very bottom of your calf. Like if you think of the medial gastroc, and there's like a region of aponeurosis that's independent of the soleus, still part of the gastroc. And then as you move more distally, it fuses with the soleus aponeurosis then to, where it becomes the Achilles tendon. So yeah, it's a free zone of aponeurosis. And I guess it facilitates force sharing. My understanding of it is it facilitates force sharing among the tricepsoarean muscles between the gastroc and the soleus. And perhaps allows a little bit of independence, because, you know, certain tasks, certain knee angles, there's a little bit of independence between how the timing of peak force from the soleus and the gastroc, so they don't always follow the same pattern, and sometimes the soleus follows a similar pattern to the vasti muscles, more so than it does the gastroc. So even just in a very, very simple way, if you look at the mid-stance of running or acceleration or even like jumping or hopping, the peak force on the solus is usually around 50% of stance phase, whereas the peak force on the gastrocs is usually around 75 or 80% of stance phase, a bit later in the stance phase. So around about the same phase of around about 50% of stance phase, you get peak force from the vastae muscles as well. So we know that the solus is the big anti-gravity muscle and a big vertical and horizontal accelerator of the center of mass. And there's also some studies that show that there's some like neuromechanical coupling relationship between the vastae muscles and the soleus. So there's one study that showed when you stimulate the femoral nerve, you get concurrent recruitment of the soleus and vice versa. There's a little bit of two-way communication between those two muscles. So I do think, go back to your original question, I think that the free gastric aponeurosis helps with that, gives us some independence, but also when time when it's needed, helps to facilitate coordination of those muscles as well, depending on the task. And when you're dealing with like a medial gastroc strain or your commonly known like tennis leg injuries, you know, it's at the distal part of the medial gastroc and the MTJ, and certainly in the higher grade cases, if you're using Carlos Pedre's classification system, use blood sound, particularly your grade 4 injuries, your free gastric aponeurosis and your gastric aponeurosis are both affected. And if you get injured to that area, you want to make sure it's well rehabbed. And if there's any bit of dysfunction or altered mechanics of the aponeurosis, it's going to upset the balance of loading within that muscle and in the other two muscles as well. So, and it can also have an impact on how the tendon is loaded, given that the tendon is made up of subtendon fascicles from the three muscles.
It kind of also reminds me of the, I can't remember his first name, the Nielsen paper that came out earlier this year, like looking at the chronic changes in the distal like medial head of the gastroc with like recurrent gastroc strains, where it was just showing that like the fascicles themselves kind of like coil under, and even when the gastroc is recruited, they don't engage in like the pination angle doesn't necessarily really change. And so it's a very interesting concept where if, again, kind of like what you're saying, if it doesn't get rehab properly, or if there's other factors that we're not able to address, it could lead to longer lasting issues that are manifesting later on down the road. Just a side little tangent.
Inform Performance is proudly partnered with Team Builder, a strength and conditioning software for performance coaches that is full of tools to help support you in your daily role. Whether it's building programs, tracking workout progress, or monitoring athlete wellness, load management, and fatigue, they've got you covered. Head to teambuilder.com and sign up with promo code INFORM to start your 30-day free trial.
When it comes to a lot of different, you know, people listen to different podcasts, people listen to look at different papers, and I feel like a lot of times there's always this frame of reference where a certain structure experiences a certain magnitude of body weight. Right. And I feel like constantly people are throwing around different areas. Sometimes people say 5 times body weight, sometimes it's 12, sometimes it's 9, sometimes it's whatever, you know. Can you help us kind of like better conceptualize, you know, when a tendon experiences certain magnitude of body weight, you know, what are those actual tensile demands of the tendon, of the muscles, and you know, how does that actually manifest within rehabilitation or within training?
We know that during, you know, slow to steady state running speeds, the Achilles tendon experiences like tensile forces of 7 to 8 times body weight. During high speed running, then that's in double digits, like 10 to 12 times body weight. And then perhaps during the hop or step phase of a triple jump or takeoff and a long jump, that can be like 15, 16 times body weight based on Comey's work back in the early 1990s using a buccal transducer, which you would never get ethics equivalent to do now. So a lot of forces are going through it, you know, and the soleus of the three calf muscles, even during, you know, steady state running to submax running speeds, the muscle force contribution from the soleus based on Doran's work and some of his colleagues is around 10 to 12 times body weight, at peak. So whereas the gastroc, it's about maybe, you know, half that or less. So the soleus is a big force producer, probably facilitated by their architecture. So it's got a multi-pinnate fiber arrangement. So the pination angle varies throughout the muscle. So a lot of fibers can be packed into the volume of muscle. And it's got different compartments as well. So I suppose the mechanics of the muscle can vary across different regions of it. And you've got that interwoven connective tissue, the peripheral aponeurosis and the intramuscular aponeurosis. And then, as I mentioned, in the free gastric aponeurosis that kind of runs slightly independent of it, but still a little indirectly connected. where the Soleus and the free gastric epirosis merge. So I suppose there's an interplay between the architecture of the muscles, the connective tissue structure, and I suppose the elastic properties of the tendon that kind of govern the force that goes through it, and also the demands that of the movement you're undertaking. So that, I suppose that there's the force magnitude or the tensile force that goes through it, and then there's the loading rate. So all the forces can be applied. If you're thinking of a sprinter, all the forces applied, and even, you know, a typical ground contact time being 0.1 of a second, but, you know, 50% of stance phase being half that, you know, around about 0.5 of a second or 0.05 of a second. So in a very, very short space of time, you know, you got 150 to 200 body weights per second of force going through the tendon. So a very, very fast stretch with a lot of force going through it. But it's designed for that, you know, it's designed for that. It's got that sort of viscoelastic structure. You've got those elastic collagen fibers, and you've got that sort of viscous sort of fluid and ground substance that facilitate fluid flow and return to shape from its deformation as it stretches. It's again, it's hard to replicate. You know, it's hard to do any calf lifting exercise that replicates, you know, double digits times body weight. That's where your plyos and your jumping comes into play. And I guess what we're trying to do is have some sort of gym measure of what's quite good calf strength looks like, whether it's twice body weight at peak force or 2.5 times body weight or even 3 in some cases. But from the main point of view, you know, we're trying to obviously make sure it's got good peak force, but also when rehabbing, we're trying to stimulate some remodeling of the tissue, whether it's muscle tissue or tendon tissue, and trying to stimulate a mechanotransduction response, you know, and improve tendon elastic qualities, which responds well to heavy slow resistance when there's enough tendon tension and enough strain magnitude. So somewhere between 4.5 to 7% strain, you know, facilitates that, improving the tendon stiffness. And we know the tendon pathological tendons tend to have reduced tendon stiffness, so we always want to restore that. So yeah, they're trying to build peak force in I suppose gym terms. There is stimulating healing response or tissue remodeling response, and then there's preparing for those loading demands by having your plyometric and your jumping and bounding exercises to, you know, prepare for those high loading rate demands, and maybe to replicate those, you know, 10 times body weight or 8 times body weight or 15 times body weight, whatever the sport may demand.
When you're talking about these sorts of the strain rates of different, you know, of the Achilles tendon and those sorts of things, obviously I think some will be familiar with the kind of subtendon structure of the Achilles and all those sorts of things, especially with the soleus, mediogastroc, lateral gastroc, all those kind of subtendons coming down. Do those specific subtendons themselves have different strain rates, or is there any kind of differences in how that how pathology may come about when we think about these various different subtendons and, you know, in the context of Achilles tendinopathy?
Yeah, no, I think that's the level of detail we need to look at a bit more. Most of the reported, like, you know, strain percentages are based on the whole tendon. So just looking at the spacement of the myotendinous junction of the medial gastroc when you do an isometric contraction, and then controlling for rotation of the calcaneus at the other end, you know, you get a measure of the elongation, and then you divide, you get to work at the percentage by dividing the whatever the change in elongation is, but you divide it by its resting length and get a measure of the strain. So you're looking at the whole tendon globally, but definitely, you know, there is definitely some variable strain throughout different regions of the tendon. And as I said, the tendon is made up of the subtendon fibers from the free muscles, and they have a spiral sort of shape, and the biggest degree of torsion occurs at the mid portion. And then you've got the deep layers of fibers that come from the soleus that form the anterior part of the tendon, and then the more superficial layers come from the two gastrocs. And then you have like anatomical variability, that you might have some variation among different individuals. So you might have different extremes of fiber torsion. So some people might have very, very, you know, very, very extreme torsions from say, like the medial gastroc wrapping right around, coming right across at more of an angle, more of an acute angle, compared to others might have less extreme levels of torsion. So that's something that's probably not easy to measure in a clinical environment, but could be relevant from a rehab point of view, because that certainly impacts how the muscles are recruited and where the distribution of strain occurs in the tendon. And then we know that in a young healthy tendon, you've got a lot of variation in strain patterns. So you've got, like, you know, uniform strain patterns between the deep and superficial layers. So that kind of varies the distribution of strain within the tendon. And then as in aging tendons and people who have had a tendinopathy, that starts to diminish. So you get less variation, and then means that the same sort of the strain is kind of imposed the same sort of area of tissue, and that maybe can cut down the options, I suppose, to deload the tissue, and then that might cause extra micro tearing there, and I suppose the potential for pathology to develop or redevelop when it's trying to remodel itself. So I suppose the next level, I suppose, is trying to have some way of measuring individual strains from those three, each of the three muscles, and you know, how that, I suppose, affects the tendon.
Especially hearing these different factors in terms of like dancing around the concept of stress sealing, right, within the tendon, kind of brings me back to some of the stuff that Keith Bard put out a couple of years back with the patellar tendon and all those sorts of things. He was pretty big beforehand on talking about supplementation. I know that your thesis had a little small section on potential, you know, factors when it comes to supplementation within tendinopathy and all those sorts of things. Could you potentially just touch on what we kind of know in terms of what could be beneficial as it pertains to supplementation, whether it's collagen or collagen with vitamin C or whatever else there is out there?
Yeah, look, I mean, it's certainly an area I'm interested in. And I mean, the evidence isn't very strong, but there's definitely some potential there. And I know Keith in particular has done a lot of pioneering work in that area. You know, so there's been some good early, you know, evidence to suggest that collagen supplementation in conjunction with exercise can improve tendon stiffness and, you know, some of the collagen resynthesis markers that can be, you know, that can be picked up on and blood testing. So, so for tendon tissue, perhaps it would be, you know, there's definitely potential there, and it's something I encourage my patients to take, you know, not suggesting it's a magic cure by any means. Certainly it will do no harm, and it may work, it may have a small effect in conjunction with rehab. There's probably less evidence for its effectiveness dealing with muscle strain injuries, even though we know that tendon tissue is involved as well. There's one study, I just can't think of the name, but they compared collagen supplementation in conjunction with supplement with leucine-rich protein versus taking protein alone, and there was no added advantage of taking collagen along with protein in terms of connective tissue remodeling. So there's probably less strong evidence in for muscle strain injuries at the moment. No, it'll do no harm if someone's access to collagen and vitamin C and maybe good quality bovine collagen. You know, there's nothing, you know, you're not going to do any harm by taking it anyway, but the effectiveness might be a little bit stronger for maybe free tendon tissue.
And I know you'd mentioned a couple of things beforehand on like previous conversations and things like that about, you know, potentials for similar things like copper or manganese or anything like that are still pretty similar.
Yeah, and that's something that hasn't been really looked at yet, because, you know, when you have like when the tendon is trying to adapt to load, mechanical loading, you've got that interplay between your MMPs, so your matrix metalloproteinases, which are involved in the breakdown of collagen, and then your TIMPs, which are your tissue inhibitors of those metalloproteinases, which are involved in the resynthesis of it. So, and you've a lot of enzyme activity going on there. And my question, I suppose, in the back of mind is, well, you know, what minerals can help to support that process, like promote a healthy enzyme response, in the tissue? So we know that copper maybe is one, and manganese as well, but just hasn't been any good quality studies that have looked at that in detail. I think that'd be an interesting RCT for someone to take on at some point.
Definitely. Speaking of RCTs, I kind of wanted to touch a little bit on the RCT that you have been conducting and have published a little bit of the data from, in terms of, you know, comparing a previous approach from, you know, Carr and Silvernagle's group to, you know, a new kind of loading approach that you guys are proposing. I think that, you know, beyond, obviously there's various differences between the two protocols, but beyond the idea of contraction type or the daily loading versus multiple times a week, I think a big consideration with these approaches is like the presence of a total like lower extremity reconditioning plan as well in conjunction with the calf and Achilles loading. Can you share with the listeners, I guess, maybe some of the reason and importance to why you included some of these kind of non-calf related resistance training exercises?
Yeah, look, I suppose a few things. Like, and again, wasn't necessarily trying to reinvent the wheel on tending up at the rehab, but some things that would have frustrated me looking back is that there was always like a traditional focus on one exercise mode. Like eccentric only was probably the main exercise of choice in the 80s and 90s. And if you're preparing someone to go back into sport that requires a lot of athletic equipment, different athletic qualities, well, one exercise is not going to prepare you for that. And then heavy store resistance became a little bit more in vogue in the, you know, early 2000s and probably certainly as effective, with less frequency compared to doing like Atherton's daily, twice daily, 300, whatever, heel drops a day, bending a straight leg, which is no fun if you're a patient who doesn't like to do exercise that much. And then I suppose the likes of Jill Cook and others who, you know, started to promote more the, you know, the preparing the tendon for the capacity need for sports. So working through like your strength phase, your stretch tolerance, and then your stretch shortness cycle, you know, capacity, and then the demands of your sport. So that's, I suppose, if there's people, you know, towards doing that. And then obviously Karen's program, you know, covers a wide range of better quality. So there's combined concentric, eccentric, there's hopping, you know, plyometrics. So it kind of covered a lot of bases, and it was probably a suitable one for us to use as a control group. And I suppose the main limitation there was it's probably less prescriptive in terms of, you know, dosage, like what sort of weight should you aim to lift, you know, what sort of sets and reps for plyometric exercises. And they use pain responses as the main criteria to progress. Whereas I guess we were looking at maybe, you know, going for like low frequency, like maybe doing 2 to 3 high intensity sessions a week. Addressing a broad range of athletic quality, so calf strength, you know, your hopping and plyometrics, running mechanics, and then kinetic chain strength too, knowing that, you know, the kinetic chain itself can be impaired by having any kind of tendinopathy. So just maybe having a broad athletic approach to rehab as opposed to like a singular approach that, you know, that has been done in the past few decades. And then I guess we want to see, well, look, can you have more of a criteria base, like rather than just using pain, can the exercise to a maximum level of tolerable pain, whether that's like a 4 out of 10 or a 5 out of 10 on a pain scale, and have a decent 48-hour response afterwards, but try to push to hit certain strength targets, you know, be able to do like a single like calf raise on a Smith machine and be able to lift at least half your body weight or 60% of your body weight off external load for sets of 8 reps. And then looking at like your reactive strength markers and looking at symmetry between limbs as a guide to progress through the levels. So that was, I suppose, what inspired me to go down that road. Even though we're in a good environment for having access to patients, there's still a lot of limitations trying to do a good RCT in that environment while combining with clinical work and everything else. And then as we started the RCT, around this time 4 years ago, then COVID hit, and then we had to stop for a few months and then get going again. So there's a lot of interruptions. We had a lot of personnel and staff changes in our clinic as well. So it became very difficult to keep the study going. So I had to close it last year and ended up having 29 participants. I think 16 and 13 in each group respectively. So it had a low sample size, but I presented some of the preliminary findings at the tendinopathy conference back in November in Valencia, and both groups got better in terms of the Visa A questionnaire changes, and both had significant within group changes. And the SSC6 group, which was the intervention that I was trying to test, had a slightly superior response Visa A improvement. So it was a 9-point difference between groups, but it just didn't reach significance for the small sample size. So I guess you can summarize it different ways, but my thing is, like, you know, that criteria based, you don't have to do a daily program of exercise, like in Karen's program. It's still a good program and it may work for some people. It may work for a recreational sports person or maybe a general population person, but for me, an elite sports person needs to go back to high level sport and need to really push hard on some of those athletic qualities. It may not be enough. Whereas doing something maybe 2 to 2 times a week where you work through your high intensity calf loading and your high intensity plyometrics and be very prescriptive about it might be more effective. From that, but look, it's not a perfect RCT by any means, but look, it might get someone that's thinking to do something a bit better.
I think it's informative, right? It's one of those papers that maybe it may not have been like the most groundbreaking thing, but it was something that moved the needle forward, and I think was very informative for a lot of different people. A couple of things that you have that you guys were measuring, right? And something that you touched on earlier in the conversation was looking at different outcome measures, looking at different KPIs from a perspective on, you know, a single leg drop vertical jump, a double leg drop vertical jump. And I think a lot of times, especially recently with, you know, the recurrence of force plate testing and how popular those sorts of things have gotten, are there certain metrics that you guys are looking at when you're, you know, testing somebody with a drop vertical jump or anything along those lines that you guys are looking at and certain criteria that you're assessing with those sorts of things? Or this has this just been, you know, we're going to track data and see what happens over time?
Yeah, I mean, we primarily use drop jumping. I suppose a bit of profile of the athletes. Are they kind of naturally elastic and can get, you know, very reactive on the ground, get good jump heights in a short compact time? Or are they maybe, you know, less sort of elastic and maybe, you know, not as bouncy? So again, just building a profile of the athlete first and foremost. As part of my thesis, I did a pilot study and a reliability study and test some of the biomechanical features of a single leg horizontal plyometric exercise. So we did a single leg horizontal rebound. So I went to fourth place rebounding for distance. Similar concept to doing like a single leg drop jump. So just get some sort of horizontal measure of your actual strength. And maybe see other things there that you find that may not be as apparent in a vertical drop jump test or vice versa. And it's interesting because even with some of the people that we do that both protocols for in our 3D lab where we can get a measure of joint power and joint work and joint stiffness, you can see slightly different strategies between if someone's got reduced ankle capacity, you can, in the vertical drop jump, you'll see maybe they can adopt more of a knee strategy. So maybe higher knee joint work and knee joint power, where you see reduced ankle power on the injured side. And then in the horizontal test, you might see a bigger contribution from the hip to make up for the reduced ankle capacity. So you can see people compensating with more of a knee strategy for a drop jump and a hip strategy for a horizontal jump. So that level of detail can often be useful, particularly with high-level athletes. So we just kind of, so having a horizontal plyometric metric as well as a vertical one, just to make sure it's going to tick all the boxes. So they're the two kind of main plyometric exercises that we would use. Sometimes we might use a multi-hop test as well, you know, like a 10-5 or something like that. Because some people just, you know, they find when they get into a pattern, they can get a better bounce as opposed to doing like a one-off drop jump. So again, it's just kind of in some way building a profile of the athlete, see what they're good at, see what they're, whether it's something else that they're maybe more comfortable doing. They will be our main plyometric assessments.
With these like plyometric assessments and understanding that, you know, sometimes people are going to be able to adopt different strategies to complete the task, are there ways around that you've found in terms of maybe a constraint that you've given them, a cue that you've given them to allow for, like you had said, you know, a knee strategy versus an ankle strategy versus a hip strategy? Have you found a way to kind of get what you want out of those plyometrics?
Yeah, so when I'm training, yeah, if I'm trying to get them to minimize knee flexion and get more spring from the ankle, doing vertical hopping where they're as tall as possible, ideally working onto one leg, and so they're raising up the opposite leg, trying to get that sort of hip lock position, and in some cases maybe go hands on hips to keep the center mass a little bit higher, or in some cases you might hold like a dowel or a light plate overhead to really kind of lift them up and try to constrain them that they have to really spring off the ankle and not able to let the center mass drop when the knee flex too much. So for vertical, for that kind of limitation or compensation, that's one strategy we might use when we're rehabbing. And then for the horizontal, what you'll often see when someone adopts more of a hip strategy is when they land in more hip flexion on that side, and they rely a lot more on hip extension to get out of it. So maybe doing vertical hops where you try to keep them in hip extension and lift the knee ankle a little bit more. So maybe similar to the vertical hopping, where that's holding something overhead, they're holding something in front of their chest, like a, you know, medicine ball or a plate or even a Swiss ball, something that keeps them from, constrains them from going into hip flexion. So they have to really feel like they're springing off the ankle to go forward, upwards and forwards. So yeah, using constraints of some sort, usually helps to address some of those limitations.
Awesome. Well, Colin, I don't want to take you for too long, but just a couple kind of wrapping up questions. But given the fact that you kind of have a lot of expertise in this area, and I'm sure that there have been plenty of times where you've kind of helped out with others in terms of assessing what other individuals are doing for their Achilles rehab programs or those sorts of things, what are some areas that you think are consistently either missed or not frequently addressed enough within an Achilles rehabilitation program that somebody listening could take away from this?
Yeah, a few things, I suppose. Going back to the type of person dealing with, and even if someone is athletic, but they're maybe a little bit older, over the age of 30, just watching out for any other systemic things that might infect tendon metabolism. So, you know, anything that might drive an irrational or non-resolving inflammatory response. Just being mindful of that, look for patterns that might maybe cause you to think a bit differently and maybe to, you know, refer them to a sports medicine consultant just to get further investigations done about his blood tests and maybe rheumatology consultation if needed. So those kind of things. You know, so looking at other health factors that might be driving this, particularly in your middle to older age people, even if they are still athletic and performing at a high level. From a, I suppose, athletic point of view, yeah, it's just trying to get the right entry point. I've had a lot of people come in and they've, you know, because they thought that doing like heel drops is the right thing to do, and if they got a nasty and stretchable tendinopathy, you're just pissing the tendon off even more so by loading into dorsiflexion early on when they're sore. So find the right entry point. We know that rest isn't the answer for a tendon. It needs stimulation in order for it to at least maintain its homeostasis and to adapt. So it's finding the right entry point that they can tolerate and progress from there. And not to get too freaked out if there's little setbacks or little flare-ups along the way. It's never like a perfectly linear rehab. You know, sometimes it is, but sometimes it isn't. And not to get too freaked out, sometimes you have to just readjust things a little bit, and that might mean dialing back, you know, some weeks, maybe pushing the next rehab session back an extra day or two to allow for more time to recover. And I guess that's what the question in my mind is. You know, we know that, you know, tendons seem to respond fairly well to, you know, between 5% and 7% strain, and maybe upwards as far as 9% strain, and it's how much calf force you need to hit that zone of strain and be able to measure tendon elongation in response to force, which is difficult to do outside of a university environment. Having some sort of a test in a clinical environment to do that, and that's something I'm trying to work on at the moment. And that can help you to individualize someone's rehab. So you can then say, okay, well, what is that? If you know that someone, say like some of the arm pads is studies in Germany, you know, most of their participants, you know, would work, do isometrics at 90% of their maximum voluntary contraction and achieve around 5% strain, which is adaptive. Well, what does that equate to for, like, say, doing a calf raise and a machine, whether it's isometric or combined concentric eccentric? So be able to quantify that. I think that's probably the future direction of individualized Achilles rehab. Yeah, and then it's just, like, I suppose, any other detail in the plyometrics. I'm always keen to look at foot strategy and how they strike the ground. You know, and there's been a few that in discussion there about, you know, whether it's better to have a 4-foot strike or a mid-foot strike when you're landing during plyometrics or rebounding. And there's, you know, we know that if you have more of a 4-foot strike, you can be more reactive. If you want to get more height, maybe you need to have a bit more of a flatter foot contact. And I'm kind of keen to know what active dorsiflexion prior to contact might do, because if you get some pre-tensioning out of the calf before contact and more lengthening of the muscle tendon unit, you might be able to get the tendon stiff at the right time as you hit the ground and get more force contribution from the calf muscles. So yeah, maybe look at that level of detail as well. So they're the main, I suppose, questions that are kind of burning in my mind.
That's awesome.
I could take on another PhD to do it, but someone else might.
Yeah, pass the baton off. I think you've done enough work, at least for the PhD, you know.
Yeah.
Right on. Well, Colin, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. I think the listeners are going to have a lot of awesome takeaways for it. In terms of a question that I really like to ask people is, given the fact that we have a listener base that is primarily SNC, sports performance, rehab a little bit, sports science a little bit, kind of in that realm, who do you think we should have on next?
Oh, good question. Who have you not had on?
Put you on the spot now.
You were. If you put me on the spot now, I should have. Yeah. Because you have a lot of good people on as it is, and I'm definitely a big fan of your podcast. God. If you're looking at, I suppose, specifically at tendons and some of the stuff we talked about, maybe Aaron Passis in Germany. I'm not sure how accessible he is, but he's been doing this stuff for decades. You know, he's a lot of landmark papers. He'd be someone I'd be loved to have a conversation with. I've seen him and I suppose spoke to him just in passing at conferences, but he'd be someone I'd love to pick his brains on a little bit more.
Awesome. I love it. Yeah, I will definitely do what I can to reach out to him and see how see how accessible he is, because yeah, you're definitely right. He may be a little bit elusive, but Colin, thank you so much. If there's any areas that people would want to reach out, how could they find you? How could they reach out to you?
Yeah, okay, that's what social media, like my Twitter handle is at Colin Griffin, and my Instagram is at Colin Griffin 50k, and then also LinkedIn. So yeah, I look, happy for it. I'm always gonna look, I mean, I've reached out to loads of people and probably annoyed a lot of people down the years, and people have been very generous at the time, so you know, I was always happy to give something back. And you know, just if you don't hear from me straight away, just be patient, I will get back eventually, and depends on the week you have. But yeah, look, always happy to have a discussion and help out in some small way if I can.
Right on. Well, Colin, thank you so much for being on the podcast. We really appreciate it, and we'll chat sometime soon.
Thank you, Dylan. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.